Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. Today we've got a very special episode for you guys. We are joined by Keith Littlewood, or Tomo Littlewood as he goes by, who is currently studying thyroid physiology and the effect of pollutants on thyroid physiology. And Keith's just a really well-versed guy on thyroid overall. It was a great conversation, and I think you guys will really enjoy it. So Keith, you want to just give a little bit, you've already been on the podcast with Jaden. Jaden could not make it today, but you want to give a little bit of a background to yourself?
Sure, I ended up being in the fitness industry after coming out of the army at an early age. After spending 4 years in the army from 17 to 21, fell into the fitness industry, got involved in personal training, rehabilitation, then got more interested into kind of lab testing. Found the work of Ray Peat, which I found really, really interesting, and other scientists. And since 2010, I kind of got interested in reading around hormones and biology. And then went back to uni in 2016 just to challenge the biases that I'd learned from reading Ray's work and other work as well around endocrinology. I did a master's and a postgrad, and I'm currently involved in researching the effects of various pollutants on thyroid physiology, doing some PhD research at the University of Reading, which is taking up, although it's part-time, it's taking up a lot of my time, but it's quite rewarding all the same.
That's awesome. Yeah, I definitely want to pick your brain on that because I think that's really interesting. But before we go into thyroid and everything like that, which is our topic of the day, I just want to ask you, how did you get into the PRI sort of stuff? Because it's funny, I also came into nutrition sort of through that lens. I don't know if you did PRI exactly, but it seemed like from your Instagram post, you've done something adjacent to it where it's talking about that similar kind of model.
Right. Okay. So I never actually studied with postural restoration. I initially got involved in structure and kind of rehab, but initially by the Czech Institute in San Diego. So I did a few of their practitioner courses out there, which I found really interesting. Developed my own nutritional dogma there as well. I then kind of got involved in therapy, neuromuscular therapy, and I taught some courses for Rocktape and neurokinetic therapy, and studied some really interesting kind of neuro rehab stuff with proprioceptive deep tendon reflex, and did a few other things like Rehab School of Prague, took some of their courses and a few other kind of, you know, movement therapy, neuroscience, pain science based courses. And I guess my role, I kind of morphed from personal trainer into kind of somebody involved in rehabilitation, pain relief, and getting people functioning at their best again. So I kind of spent a few years really from about 2005, really up until about 2020 when I decided to knock that work on its head, which was, you know, have been like an extension of being in the fitness industry from 1995. And it was very rewarding and, you know, certainly kind of spurred my interest in understanding neuroscience, neurobiology. And it's kind of made me where I am today. So it's been an integral part. And although I don't kind of do any therapy work or kind of that type of work anymore, it's certainly served as a useful foundation for understanding biological processes a little bit better.
Yeah, that I really enjoy the lens which the postural restoration and that sort of thing looks at the body, and at least in the injury aspect. And it's just a different aspect for where they talk about the pressure gradients and things like that and how that can affect your sleep and stuff like that, which I know you like to talk about. I just thought it was interesting, like kind of intertwining those areas of health and the pain. I'm sure you seem to have a deep knowledge from back in the day of all that sort of stuff. And I'm sure a lot of that applies to like the Ray Peat work, and kind of integrating it is really interesting perspective, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I kind of, somebody experienced a pain, I kind of put my back out snowboarding last week because a variety of reasons. But, you know, I think understanding that you're probably more likely to experience pain when your biology is not where it should be, when the body's inflamed, you know, how, you know, increases in serotonin and gut problems, hormone problems, and it becoming a vicious cycle with altered sleep, wake cycles. I think it's important to understand those things. And generally, I think understanding your structure, because, you know, we all have, you know, the same amount of bones to a degree in our body, levels of function from muscle, fascia, skin, on organs. But, you know, we all have these subjective nuance, whether it's inherited traits or whether it's damage that we acquire over our lifetime. Nothing worse than an ankle injury throwing everybody's structure out. Nothing worse than an eye injury throwing everybody's structure out. You know, there's kind of multiple levels from your neurological to the biomusculoskeletal kind of framework that can have an effect. And I think understanding those is, you know, I quite like to see practitioners when they kind of have that kind of physical, biomechanical, neurological background with, and then come in and try and implement that with kind of good solid nutrition and hormone strategies. But for me, doing the two was just too much. And I really wanted to pursue some research and, you know, instead of arguing with people on social media, try and do something that's going to challenge me. And also, you know, I was late to going to school. I left school at an early age, at the age of 15, to go into the army. So it wasn't really my time then. But I think since 2016, at least, going back to university and, you know, challenging to try and learn more about the human body has been quite important. So that's why I left the kind of rehab stuff behind, because I think it's impossible to do to kind of, you know, research and coaching still. I mean, that's how I earn my money, is coaching people and working with people. So it was something that had to go. I do miss, you know, the client interaction for sure, because most of my work now is all via Zoom, to be honest.
Yeah, I definitely envy you a little bit going back to school later. I went to school right out of high school and I just didn't take it very seriously. I was a, you know, biology major, but I was there more for drinking than for the education. And now, like, having dove so much more into Ray Pete's work, I like really wish I had that. I mean, they don't teach it to you with an applicable lens. A lot of times you're learning this organic chemistry, it's all theoretical and it seems very abstract from the outside world. But when you come back and I'm like, damn, now I want to dive back into organic chemistry and all this good stuff, and now I can actually see how it applies. It's such a different perspective I have on it. So it's one of my regrets. Can always keep learning that.
Well, we will have regrets. Never too late to go back. That's all, what I say. I mean, I'm at 51 and starting a PhD. And, you know, that's going to take 6 years of my life. It's never too late for anybody, really.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, cool. So let's dive into the thyroid. So I wanted to just give a brief synopsis to the listeners and kind of give my current understanding. And if you feel free to stop me at any point. So thyroid, basically this butterfly shaped gland in the neck, and its primary role is to secrete these hormones T3 and T4, which are known as triiodothyronine, thyronine, and tetraiodothyronine, or thyroxine, which is the more common name. The T dash number referring to how many iodine molecules are bound. The pivotal function of these hormones is to regulate metabolism or oxygen consumption in the body. And then T3 being the active form and T4 having be converted to T3, which happens primarily in the liver. And then if there isn't adequate amounts of these hormones, you have TSH, or thyroid stimulating hormone, being released from the pituitary. And then I thought it was also worth mentioning just for the listeners that none of these hormones travel by themselves in the blood. They are all carried by thyroid carrying proteins like transthyretin, albumin, thyrotropin, and thyroid binding globulin. Anything I missed there you'd like to add?
That's a good synopsis. I think that's a good place to start for sure.
Sweet. So the first question I wanted to ask was about, how does T3 regulate glucose oxidation, or is it more so related to the burning of fuel as an oxygen for energy, both fat and glucose?
I think there's probably some bi-directional feedback, is that it depends on what's going on and what's going on chronically. So T3 is pro-oxidative, which means it will help to utilize the oxidation of both glucose and fatty acids. Now, neither of those is detrimental, but to the extent that I think chronically we favor chronic fatty acid oxidation, it does have some downstream effects of increasing the lipid peroxides, increasing the byproducts like malondialdehyde, depletes glutathione as an example. And people who've looked at, say, the fatty acid cycle or Randall cycle will kind of have some idea of what goes on there. So I think to the extent that you can apply the idea that T3 and carbohydrate tend to be efficient by how much carbon dioxide oxide they produce now by the oxidative metabolism or the complex pathway, is that to the extent that you use carbohydrates, you will produce more carbon dioxide. And that begins to be a more kind of efficient self fulfilling factor. Whereas if you're kind of utilizing fatty acids all the time, the respiratory quotient is as high as 0.7. And it's efficient in the fact it gives you a lot of energy. But to the extent that there is a trade-off of having more oxidation going on, negative oxidation, and these negative byproducts being produced. So I think T3 can regulate carbohydrate metabolism, as it can regulate fatty acid oxidation. To the extent also that when there's not enough TO3 around, we do tend to see that oxidative metabolism becomes compromised and can inhibit both the optimal metabolism of both carbohydrates and fats, not to the extent that it's going to go chronically into or straight away into glycolysis. But if aerobic glycolysis is maintained, that tends to have some negative effects downstream. Lactic acid, which again, lactic acid isn't necessarily bad, but to the extent that it's constantly being utilized as or being produced as part of the glycolytic pathway, it will cause multiple problems downstream where that becomes problematic. And, you know, there are many reasons why. And I think you wanted to talk maybe perhaps about parathyroid hormone later on. And there's certainly reasons why excess lactic acid, excess inflammation can lend itself to kind of parathyroid activation, poor thyroid use, and generally the theme of increased inflammation, which can play havoc with everything.
So if the role of T3 in the cell, if we're going to like draw a picture, is it kind of like, I think people describe it as the gas kind of where it gets the cell to, you know, start firing up. But also has like the stabilization property, I would say, that where like it really helps to conduct energy flow efficiently through the cell. Would you say that's kind of accurate or more? Like, is that a good analogy?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, there are multiple things about T3 that we know and that we don't know. I mean, T3 has two specific properties, non-genomic and genomic. The genomic ones are, you know, the translation of genes and how that is affected. And we know that when in hypothyroidism, that gene expression becomes problematic when it's not being regulated in that way. The non-genomic actions still haven't been really thoroughly investigated to give a complete picture. Mm. I've spoken to some metabolic experts who think that T3 acts like an antioxidant at the cell membrane. Now, the idea of the cell membrane is something that is beyond the discussion we have today, because it depends how you view the construct of the cell membrane and whether lipid bilayers exist or how important cytoskeleton is or how important ordered water at this kind of property level between cells functions. So, but it's interesting to hear that somebody who I spoke to who wrote an interesting paper on thyroid has come around to the idea that thyroid acts as an antioxidant. But in a nutshell, if you see it that way, you come up with the idea that thyroid hormone, particularly T3, lends itself to optimal energy production. So in essence, it would mean that you would have less antioxidants being used up. The redox pathway of reduction and oxidation becomes more efficient, and it isn't kind of disturbed when you have adequate thyroid hormone. So it has this antioxidant-like effect anyway, but they seem to be present around this area as well. And obviously we have the, you know, T3 that's taken into the cell via its various transporters beyond what's in the blood. You talked about transthyretin, thyroid-binding globulin, transthyretin, albumin. They're the most dominant players in that order. I think 75% is TBG. I think about 15 to 20% is transthyretin, and then the rest is albumin. And then you have the smaller carrier proteins like the monocarboxylate transporters, 8 and 10, which is specific to kind of cell type, more being in the brain with 8. And then you have, how that binds. So you'll have the how thyroid kind of binds with its ligand binding domain within the cell and creates that gene transcription. And that's the thyroid response elements creating that response. And usually that synergizes with another receptor, which is called the retinoin X receptor. So we know that retinol and thyroid have a specific kind of stabilizing factor within the cell. So there's kind of multiple levels of transport and communication and binding. And I think it's quite interesting to think that there's still a lot more that we could learn. Like people talk about the idea around T2 as an example, mm-hmm. as being a pro-metabolic form of thyroid hormone. And again, we just don't know enough about that yet.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I really like the idea that I'll have to read that paper that you mentioned about the T3 being an antioxidant, but I also really like the idea or the concept that a molecule could seem to be like an antioxidant when it, by reducing the antioxidant load almost by making the energy production pathway smoother. So there's a small requirement of antioxidants. So it almost has an antioxidant effect, which I don't know if it's exactly what you were saying, but
exactly.
Okay. And then I would have thought that T3, like in my speculation, we would have acted more like a quinone, kind of like methylene blue. But that's interesting that you say it's more like a, because I wouldn't have thought it'd be like a reductant, like an antioxidant, but that's interesting. I'll have to check out that paper.
Yeah, what I find really interesting is that the ideas behind methylene blue is that, for example, methylene blue, most of the studies suggest that when people take methylene blue, there's an increase in thyroid hormone within the blood. Now, my guess behind that is that given that methylene blue has capacity to act as a donator and acceptor, I think it can facilitate that kind of end pathway in cytochrome C and actually reduce the need for thyroid hormone. So I think sometimes that increase in thyroid hormones in the blood might be actually a temporary, not total loss of them because they're essential, but temporarily it might just appear that that's acting in that pathway and increasing the thyroid bloods. You don't see many studies beyond that about why that's actually happening. And I don't think people know the mechanism of that from any studies of methylene blue, but I find that component quite useful, not to suggest that that's a pathway that wants to be maintained long term, because obviously there are many negative effects of not having enough thyroid hormone being used. Not to say that methylene blue isn't safe long term. There's plenty of studies that show that actually small doses of that are actually quite helpful. But it's interesting to see. And I have seen some clients who've used methylene blue at higher doses for longer periods with some negative symptoms, you know, they resolve when they come off that. So I think there are some kind of risks and rewards that need kind of looking at that from a thyroid perspective.
When it comes to T4, two questions. One, does the thyroid mostly produce T4 in smaller amounts, T3, or do you have any idea of that? And then is T4's main role being converted into T3? It's kind of like more of a, you know, send more of it out and have it get dispersed throughout the body?
Well, I think the basic idea, and this is just the common idea, that T4 is supposed to be converted to T3. I think there are some other effects of T4 and that they've been investigated. I think the general consensus is that it's a 4-to-1. So around about 3 to 4 parts of T4 to T3 produced in the thyroid gland itself. I think with T4, both thyroid hormones can have proliferative effects. They're growth hormones. They act as organizational hormones. They lend themselves to levels of complexity. There is some interesting research that's come out on long chronic, and it's really associational at the moment. So it's not causative in any way. It's just an association between, say, levothyroxine users, which is LT4, which is the synthetic form of thyroid hormone, and the incidence of cancer. And there was a small association between the two. And that's because the way that T4 works, it can bind to the kind of the membrane receptor and cause increased proliferation by working with the proteins of actin, F-actin. And that might be that there could be too much T4 being around and not in that ratio of adequate T4 to T3. I think it works by something called the integrin VB3 receptor. It's something that they've looked at with that particular mechanism. And I think it's useful to postulate that when there's an excess of T4 and there's not enough T3 around, that could be some of the problems that are occurring because of that. Mm-hmm. But like I said, that's just associational at the moment. But I think it kind of goes back to that dogmatic belief around is synthetic T4 enough to treat the hypothyroid patient or person. And I still don't think it's the right approach. And that's kind of what I'm trying to look at with research over the next couple of years to see what disrupts hormones, what kind of blocks them, how many levels of problems are there, you know, because everyone thinks about, you know, you talked about how perhaps the thyroid is produced. We get, you know, you get a response from the hypothalamus to produce thyroid releasing hormone, which sensitizes the thyrotrophs in the pituitary to produce thyrotropin or TSH, which then sensitizes the thyroid to produce this. I think that's just one feedback loop. I think there are plenty of other feedback loops that would contribute to that. But if we were just saying, hey, this is the feedback loop that we know exists of positive and negative feedback that circulating T4 and T3 could cause the pituitary to not produce any more TSH. Well, what happens then when, say, the thyroid receptor, and the thyroid receptor can be bound by its ligand, which is T3. Mm. And it can also be bound by a non-ligand, which has a very similar kind of structure, but doesn't interact with it fully. And that's what we see with multiple pollutants. There are some that potentially bind within this receptor. So then you have to ask the question, does it have a ligand response and produce the action of T3, or just does it sit in that receptor and not cause that response to happen? So if that's occurring, then you could argue, well, T3 is not binding to the receptor because it's being blocked by a very similar chemical compound. So that means the circulating value of T3 could actually elicit part of the feedback loop that tells the hypothalamus that there is a normal thyroid blood level. And so you won't see an increase in TSH, but you might see increases in T4 and T3 because they're not being utilized. And that, you know, the body should, you know, produce T4 and T3 or should be able to convert T3 in other structures beyond the liver and the thyroid gland. In fact, it's going all the time. It happens in the brain all the time. The brain will conserve T3 levels there because it's really important to have, you know, loads of T4 and T3 in the brain to make the brain function efficiently. That's why transthyretin is a very important carrier in the brain for humans. And unfortunately, in rodents, it's the primary carrier for most of the mouse model of thyroid and thyroid disease. So there's lots of differences between the two.
So what you're saying in terms of the pollutants is that basically, you know, T3 normally binds to its ligand, which like its receptor, and that normally allows it to exert its effects where it increases metabolism, all the beneficial stuff that T3 does. But instead of T3, something that's similarly shaped like a pollutant binds to the receptor and it may or may not activate it the same way. And the issue, I think, would be that it does not activate it. So it's not having that response. Maybe it's both ways. And then so the body doesn't, because there are still normal amounts of T3 and T4 in the blood, that the body doesn't simulate, hey, we need to upregulate TSH or we need to increase their production. Because they are in the blood, they are being produced, they're just not being utilized.
Yeah, I think it's useful to speculate on that. And again, there's not lots of studies on it. Hmm. There are some studies, and it depends which pollutant you're looking at, because there are kind of multiple levels of inhibition. So, for example, one pollutant I'm really interested in at the moment is the novel flame retardant DBDPE, which is one of the only, it's a newer flame retardant. It's been increasing substantially. It's one of the most common pollutants found in house dust. It seems to, in vitro at least, it seems to have a capacity to inhibit the deiodinases, which are essential for, converting T4 to T3 or T3 to reverse T3. So I think it's really important to understand that all of these pollutants, some have very different actions. Some might have something like that you just talked about. Some might have a totally different capacity. Like some of the pollutants increase the degradation of T3 at the liver. And you can see these kind of protein expressions. Something's called EROD or PROD, or you see the increased glucuronidation or breakdown of kind of thyroid hormones at the liver, and they're kind of passed out through the system. So again, I think there's multiple levels of thyroid disruption here, and it becomes complicated. So you kind of have to work on each individual one to see what it does, or even at least combine them at certain levels.
It's almost like you have to do a PhD to understand them.
Yeah, almost.
Is that flame retardant the one they're mandating in children's clothing? Do you know? Have you seen that?
There's certainly in fabrics. Certainly, in fact, if you Well, to be honest, I mean, I think DPDP has been banned in Canada, but it's increasing Europe. It's certainly produced in the US as well. Typical place it's found: house dust, offices. It's in lots of furniture. It's very present in the car. It tends to increase in kitchens. So there are flame retardants in the components of kitchenware. And when they heat up, they actually tend to release a little bit more into the air. A lot of the studies where they've looked at it, they've compared Chinese factory workers where DPDP is produced and then kind of assess, 30 miles away in a residential area of non-factory workers. And both of them have quite high levels of DPDP in their blood, in the serum. And it's also quite common to be found in breast tissue. There are even more complications coming around from this particular one and others. Bear in mind, this is just one of thousands, right? So is the accumulation. DPDP is different from the other flame retardants, is that it's quite hydrophobic, so it doesn't mix with water. It requires like a fat-soluble component. However, in the aquatic life forms that are being looked at, if you combine titanium dioxide, which everybody knows is this ubiquitous kind of additive to foods, it's banned in Europe, but in the US it's still very common. We still find it in lots of our foods here, even though supposedly it's banned, but it's there. It's a kind of like white product. For an example, I think in the US in Skittles, the white S on there is titanium dioxide. So nanoparticles of titanium dioxide allow these pollutants to become absorbed at a much quicker rate. And instead of being passed out very quickly, actually aquatic life forms seem to accumulate these flame retardants even more. But then you have the BDEs, which are the kind of these persistent organic pollutants of flame retardants. They've been banned, but they're around for a long period of time. And then you can add in the PFOAs from the Teflon. You can add in pretty much everything, and they're there. And that's why understanding there are various kind of areas that you can work on, I think, not to mitigate these things, but I certainly see there's some research that have come out in amphibians and tadpoles and zebrafish, which have a good thyroid kind of model, and has shown that actually where these pollutants have had growth and movement inhibiting effects, when you give them adequate T3, that can tend to be resolved, which I find quite interesting, which lends itself to the idea that T3 has a significant role to play, I think, in thyroid therapy, particularly if you live in a polluted area or you're kind of, surrounded by these compounds.
Do you think a lot of these compounds has to do with, so I don't know if BDP or BDBE is one of the halogens, but a lot of the thyroid disruptants seem to be either fluoride, bromide, or chloride. Versus like the PFAs and the PFOAs seem to have more of an estrogenic effect. Do you think those are having most of the direct thyroid disruptors? Do you think is mostly from the halogens interfering with iodine metabolism, or do you think the PFAs and all that stuff can have an equally indirect or direct effect?
Well, I think they're probably combined because it's hard to get away from one or the other, right? I mean, the flame retardants, the biggest thing is they're brominated. Mm-hmm. So they have that effect. When you look at things like glyphosate, they tend to have the capacity to restrict iodine. So you can have a double whammy effect of perhaps very, very low levels of, say, glyphosate in food, as an example, or in not in water supplies. It shouldn't be there. I don't know if it's been detected or not. But we know, say, if you're eating potentially a diet high in genetically modified foods, there are going to be traces of glyphosate. In Brazil, for example, that there are going to be very high traces of paraquat because it's a very common pesticide that's used. Now, these are very, very, very nanoparticle sized things. But what happens when they accumulate and then you mix them with multiple other pollutants that might be causing the problem? So it can come back to the idea that some can be estrogenic and mm-hmm. some can have very different pathways. So yes, absolutely. It's a combination. I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's a convergence of all of these kind of different molecules and what they do, how they interact electrostatically in the body, what kind of charge they have, how they interact with phosphates. All of these things can have an effect where potentially it could be a tip over into pathophysiology and disease.
So do you think because there are so many thyroid toxins that are ubiquitous in our environment today, that makes it a lot harder to classify one of these things as all right, we have to get rid of this Like, why do you think there have been so many toxins? And this could be complete speculation, or maybe you have a more thought out answer, but like, how do all these things get in by the FDA and all these things that shouldn't probably are having, definitely are having an effect and probably should not be there?
Well, I think that's it. There are multiple levels to that, is that the EPA tests haven't been appropriate at detecting problems before. Typically you've gone for the no observed excess level or load, which, you know, you've got this kind of linear dose looking for what causes the negative effects. So typically you've always looked for a clear endpoint. So let's say you had 0, 5, 10, 15, and 200. And perhaps the 200 caused a problem, but the other ones didn't. So there was assumed, unless you went really, really high doses, there wasn't effect. But the idea now is, because there are so many chemical cocktails out there, is that even those very, very, very small ones, that, or whether they've been considered sublethal concentrations, they interact very, very differently. And I think that's where some of the problems have occurred. We're always looking for this kind of clear and immediate intervention, cause and effect. And some chemicals don't do that. But then you've also only looked at, say, typically some have only looked at blood tests in the past. Some haven't looked at the molecular kind of downstream effects. And also, if we look at some of those studies, for example, we might see T4 and T3 in there, but hey, there was no change to TSH. And by definition, if you're looking at clinical endocrinology, if there's no change to TSH, people just say, well, there's no effects. And if you have that's where you kind of have this belief in the system that, okay, the TSH becomes, it's gold standard, and everybody just buys that, and they don't look into it themselves. And I think that's a considerable failing of medical training, is that we consider that a biochemistry test is a gold standard, given that we have all this other extra molecular information. That's really kind of what spurred me on to do studies, is that, you know, there's a lot about biochemistry that we can look at, but to compare the molecular effects with the chemistry effects, there are studies out there doing that. I'm not doing anything that's kind of novel at the moment, apart from looking at some of the newer kind of pollutants. I think that's one of the idea. I think corruption is obviously the biggest idea as well. There are many kind of lobbyists and chemical companies that will pay people to suppress negative data. Again, it's just like this biology and how biology artifacts occur, and the convergence of multiple issues that disrupt physiology, whether it's at a transgenerational level or in the immediate environment themselves, is that you get conversions of these nefarious factors, whether it's not testing appropriately, whether it's corruption, and all of the other factors that go with it.
Is another issue, which I think you kind of alluded to, that these compounds, like they'll test, let's say you use a 200 and 200 kills you, but they don't test necessarily the long-term effects of how point, let's say 5, can accumulate over time.
Yeah, and what's called the BAF, or the bioaccumulation factor, is something that's being looked at more. And that's where you want to see studies where you have transgeneration effects. And there are some suggestions now, and there are a few studies that show that TSH set point could be altered in utero. So it's like, you know, what's going on? Bearing in mind, a lot of these pollutants can cross the placental barrier. That's quite possible. And again, if you're getting these kind of levels of interference where you're getting molecular docking with kind of non-thyroid polluting chemicals that kind of bind to that receptor and have either a positive, negative, or some effect on the thyroid physiology, and also steroidogenesis as well. We know that thyroid disrupting chemicals also share common pathways with kind of, you know, steroid disrupting chemicals as well. So this, if you're looking at damage within, you know, offspring, how long does that take to occur? So, you know, could it be that the thyroid dependent structures like the pancreas or the liver or the eyes? I mean, what we're seeing now is certainly we're seeing more states of disease and pathophysiology across the board. There's just no denying that. So, and some people say, well, we're analyzing it more because we have bigger telescopes and we can see more stars. And it's like, yeah, okay, I get that. But at the same point, I see way more people around with kind of certain issues. And you could argue that's just my observation bias that's kind of looking at that. But it's like, there are certainly more metabolically compromised and biologically compromised individuals around. And I think that that's part of the problem, to be honest.
I completely agree. And I think you see it's becoming normalized, in my opinion, where you're seeing so many more people that, like, things like anxiety have become just, like, you know, ubiquitous. Everyone has anxiety. And I don't necessarily think that should be the case. Obviously, the world is not all butterflies and rainbows. And, you know, but that's always the case. That there's world could always be better. And, that, and, you know, that's definitely going to have an effect. But I feel like some of these things are just so ubiquitous, low T, all these things are just adding up. But I did want to stop you on that. You said the TSH set point. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. So that would just basically mean that TSH, when it should be produced or stop being produced. So again, if you have these kind of levels of interaction between the pollutants and how they bind to the thyroid receptor. So if, and it goes back to that point again I made earlier on. Let's say there's a certain class of chemicals that could bind or do bind to the thyroid receptor. So sometimes the receptor could actually be replaced by a compound that will either elicit a response. We can certainly see some increases in, say, hyperthyroidism from certain pollutants, but also that would mean that they're actually having that effect where it increases the biological action at the thyroid receptor because it appears that T3 or a T3-like compound is binding and causing that response. But equally, you can get interactions at this kind of binding domain where it's a very weak bind, so it doesn't elicit the response that T3 would always create. So you could argue with that as if the circulating value is going around because they're not binding to the receptor because there's an increase in these chemicals that are binding to them. That would alter the TSH set point. If that's occurring in utero, there are disturbances that would present themselves later on in life because ultimately the thyroid is not being managed effectively. And this is why you can come to see, you know, within humans, there are other blood tests that might be quite useful for forming an opinion around whether someone's hypothyroid or not. It might be an increase in cholesterol values. It might be an increase in the red blood cell chemistry. It might be a decrease in hemoglobin, a decrease in hematocrit. It might be an increase in RDW, the red cell distribution, which is correlated with thyroid disorders, which can also present as, you know, poor cardiac function as well. You might see increased segments within, say, an ECG that can correlate with that. So you're not necessarily always going to see this overt presentation of thyroid. And the idea around subclinical hypothyroidism and its progression to overt can take years, absolutely years before that occurs. So it's, I think it's useful to consider that the TSH could be changed, and it might be harder to pick up the findings of low thyroid function. Hence why there are doctors going back to the 40s and 50s, like Broder Barnes, which Ray Pete always cited, and other ones that kind of poo-pooed the idea of the TSH being a really good marker, and that basal metabolic rate, Achilles tendon reflex, perhaps his blood tests that I suggested, could be a cholesterol test, could be a really good indicator of overall thyroid function. You know, there are symptoms as well, whether it's cognition, brain fog, constipation, you know, infertility, menstrual disorders, low T. But again, these kind of symptoms can have different presentations. I generally find with a lot of even low thyroid people that when you sort their diet out, they can actually go to toilet and not be constipated and still have low thyroid symptoms. So it just depends on, I think, you know, what are the factors that kind of cause, say, the thyroid to be dysfunctional. So if you say, I use constipation as an example, if you're kind of relatively low thyroid, you might be constipated, but then your ability to digest food, you might have more problems with grains, you might have you know, more problems with other foods, you might be eating high foods that diet high in foods that causes you to become more constipated. You might be eating a diet high in compounds that suppress thyroid function somewhat. So when you change the diet, motility improves. But I'm saying going from 2 or 3 days to perhaps going once a day. But equally, my desire would be to get someone to go to the toilet 2 to 3 times a day. So it depends how you view that symptom of constipation and its nuance with the client.
Do you think that, so TSH, like you go to the doctor and get a thyroid, maybe not thyroid panel, but like, you know, go and get your normal test. For thyroid, a lot of times they'll only measure TSH, right? That's kind of their ubiquitous measure.
That generally is the theme. And the more clients I've worked with in different countries, that seems to be the constant theme by the average clinician, physician, that, you know, that is it. And I think the more authoritarian the country, and I kind of draw on Australia and Canada, the more ingrained these medical doctrines are and kind of stop the, are more designed to stop the clinician thinking for themselves.
So do you see TSH all over the place where it's like, or in a lot of the people that you work with that end up being hypothyroid, do you typically see it higher? Because I know Ray's talked about, like, I've never seen a healthy person. I think he said over two. I forget what the unit is. But or do you see some people like with what you would deem a healthy TSH level and still demonstrating clinically, not clinically maybe, but demonstrating hypothyroidism?
Yeah, it's 2 mL, and I think that's a really good kind of heuristic for looking at issues, because I get so many people that come back with TSHs around about the 2 mark, and they're still kind of pretty much like hypothyroid. So I think it's a good marker. I see plenty of people in 3s and 4s. I see plenty of people with really low and still have kind of like a low thyroid function. I mean, there are other things as well that can contribute to that. I mean, we know, for example, that if you're not looking at someone's diet or understanding their stress, they're going to present with low TSH. You know, low calorie diet, malnutrition can present with low TSH, primarily because the energetic function of the individual is compromised, and sometimes the hormone function is. It's a bit like if you're kind of starving yourself or not eating efficiently, whether you're male or female, you might see low testosterone or low progesterone production. So it's the same thing. You know, the TSH is a pituitary output. It doesn't always represent the systemic values of the body. So we have no idea which tissues are technically hypothyroid. And yet you can usually get a good idea from kind of talking to someone, looking at questionnaires and function, their energy, their body temperature, their aspects of function, generally from anywhere from mood. I mean, you talked about anxiety and depression, although considered probably, opposite ends of the scale of kind of mood issues. It's like thyroid disease, and particularly hypothyroidism, is associated with both increases in anxiety and depression.
I was listening to some of your podcasts preparing for this, and I was listening to the one with Matt Blackburn from a while ago, and I thought it was really well said. You talked about how a lot of times you get tissues that are issues in the tissues that are already least disorganized. So it's like you get stabbed where you're already weakest, and that's where a lot of these problems end up being. I thought that was a really useful, and I'm butchering your quote, but really useful thing to think about, like why certain things appear. Because a lot of, in the Ray P world, most of what we believe is that there's like kind of one disease, more or less, and it's lack of energy production in a lot of ways, at least. And why it appears in all these different ways is something that has always been bouncing around in my head.
Yeah, I mean, certain organs, I mean, you can apply that to cancer physiology. And one of the cancer physiology hypotheses is the seed and soil hypothesis. It's like, you know, you have it here and it metastasizes off to places where it's compromised. You'll get increases in nitric oxide and vascular endothelial growth factor, and, you know, it can flood off to other places. And I think the idea is that, organs, for example, accumulate fats around them, and they can also absorb a lot of the pollutants that are around and be problematic in that area. So they can lend themselves to this kind of a lot of being surrounded by problematic compounds. And I think within tissue, we always tend to say, so somebody might get pancreatic cancer and they haven't had diabetes, as an example, but they kind of don't realize how much the pancreas is doing and how much, you know, the pancreas requires just as much thyroid hormone as all of the other organs. And it could be systemic. The idea around kind of localized hypothyroidism, where there's an influx of all these pollutants that could cause multiple levels of inhibition of function and create the potential for mutations. Now, whether that's kind of derived from the lack of thyroid hormone, whether it's an excess of nitric oxide increased by estrogen, whether it's, a lack of light and issues with kind of copper metabolism, there are multiple levels of kind of insults that kind of converge. And, you know, I think thyroid is still important to consider as being a driver of this, and why kind of Broda Barnes talked about how many of the percentage of the population is potentially low thyroid. Because I think to the extent that we keep looking at these thyroid blood tests and they're normal and thinking, well, actually people have just got cancer because of a genetic trait that's causing that. And I think genetic traits are very rare when it comes to kind of causing disease. Sure, they do exist. Mm. But to the extent that your biology is disorganized by not producing enough thyroid hormone, not being able to regulate energy, not being able to kind of, you know, really utilize the oxidative complex efficiently and chronically over time. Not to say that you wouldn't switch in and out. We know the menstrual cycle switches in and out of kind of glycolysis and oxidative phosphorylation, because estrogen drives that and increases tissue in reproductive tissues. So I think it's I think the disorganization of biology is probably most easily compromised by not having enough thyroid hormone. And I, unfortunately, I still think it, for many, it's kind of difficult to come up with that idea that thyroid hormone is suppressed as progesterone is suppressed. Mm-hmm. I think there are so many things to consider with that.
So does CO2 have an effect on increased, you increase glucose oxidation, the burning of sugar, which increases the respiratory quotient, so you're producing a lot more CO2. Does that have a feedback loop sort of effect on the thyroid, where it's like, okay, you have this high levels of CO2, so that's going to cause an increase in T3 and T4 production?
Yeah, I think the idea around carbon dioxide is probably a useful self-fulfilling cycle. And I think the problems occur is because, although the idea that perhaps acidity, particularly outside the cell, the pH would decrease, it would become more acidic, particularly if there's an increase in lactic acid, which would directly impede oxidative metabolism and therefore decrease the amount of carbon dioxide. But the problem that then starts to occur is because there's this increased acidity, the body would buffer that by increasing hyperventilation, which would get rid of carbon dioxide to help to stabilize the extracellular environment, which would be becoming slightly more acidic. So I think that becomes a problem in pathophysiology, and whether it's, you know, the increase in lactic acid, which could come from a number of pathways, particularly loss of glucose oxidation, particularly from certain pollutants. I think that the loss of carbon dioxide is going to be particularly problematic in glucose oxidation. And there's some really interesting studies where they've kind of like shown that, I think I looked at one in Iran where they were using kind of, and I'm sure there are more of these, you know, using carbon dioxide to treat diabetic foot ulcers. And actually they're resolved in nearly 100% of the cases. And I think, you know, they were using a certain carbon dioxide bath. But equally, I think that could have been achieved by just rubbing a plastic bag around the foot as well.
Carbon dioxide is so interesting. Mm. One of the ways I got into fitness, or when I got into PRI a little bit, they were talking about CO2. It was my first time hearing about the importance in that aspect. So I thought that was really fascinating, hearing the two mix. But so do you think there's any sort of feedback loop from the cells burning glucose that helps the thyroid out, besides, is it CO2 or in general?
That helps the thyroid out. I think to the extent that an excess of fatty acid oxidation, which we talked about, could have some detrimental effects on the oxidative pathway when it's chronic. I don't think there's so much short term. Mm. And also the idea that the increase in carbon dioxide would help to kind of maintain that kind of optimal cycle. I think also as well, when there's an abundance of fatty acids, whether it's saturated or unsaturated, but more so unsaturated, if there's an excess of fats and it becomes cytotoxic, an excess of fats can also bump T4 off transthyretin, as an example. So mm-hmm. If you get an excess, the brain loves to use glucose as a fuel, but if it gets too much fats, then it can be not only have these kind of excess lipid peroxides, but it could also bump T4 off for transthyretin. Now, when transthyretin starts to misfold, particularly in older people, that's where we tend to see, you know, the aggregation of kind of misfolded proteins like, beta amyloid, which isn't necessarily bad. It's a kind of useful protective structure. But when it becomes misfolded, which can happen, I think, in the presence of an excess of polyunsaturated fatty acids and metals like aluminium and particularly you know, the HUFAs, the highly unsaturated fatty acids, I think this can cause many problems there. So to answer your question, because I feel like I'm digressing slightly, is that I just think carbon dioxide can be useful for bringing the system back to kind of a useful kind of grounding position of where normal is. And that's why I see quite a lot of people benefit from carbon dioxide, whether it's breath holding, whether it's kind of bag breathing. Some people have even kind of talked about using the idea of, you know, citric acid combined with bicarbonate to produce carbon dioxide and produce some reasonably interesting results. So I just think carbon dioxide can help to improve the oxidative metabolism when there's a specific issue around, you know, poor glucose use, perhaps switching more to kind of fatty acid oxidation or rampant fatty acid oxidation because they can't use glucose efficiently. And, you know, there are other benefits, you know, whether it's for bone health and other aspects of function. So, yeah, I think carbon dioxide is pretty useful.
Yeah. And also what you said, that burning the glucose will lower the free fats in the blood, which will decrease the amount that are binding to thyroid in general compared to burning large amounts of fat, which is related to the point. Next question I wanted to ask, how are T3 or thyroid and B1 related? I know you like that thiamine a lot. What, in your view, is like the purpose of using thiamine?
Well, I think it's useful within kind of complex one of the electron transport chain, because primarily, you know, I think both B1, B2 and B3 are very useful carbohydrate modulators. They help to utilize carbohydrates efficiently. And I think it's like anything, you can get blocks in the chain. So, you know, if there's insufficient thiamine, it's going to impede complex one, insufficient riboflavin, and then, you know, niacinamide, can all of those things can have an effect where energy production is restricted. So whether it's kind of, you know, reductive metabolism that you're stuck in, not producing enough NAD or not enough NAD being recycled. So, you know, that again, in that complex one pathway, thiamine and niacinamide can have a substantial effect there, as is riboflavin. So I think thiamine is certainly the most important in that kind of entry into oxidative metabolism. And when there's not enough there, whether it's from, you know, an increase in thiaminases, pollutants, if there's an increase in carbohydrate that's not being met by having adequate thiamine, all of these things can be a rate limiting factor, as it could be with any of their, you know, that could be copper, it could be ubiquinone, you know, CoQ10, the thyroid hormone. There are many effects that could when there's not enough there, that could impede that pathway, as there could be, as I said, pollutants, estrogens, and excess of nitric oxide, all of these things that can stop the aerobic metabolism working.
So you mentioned thiaminases there, which I had never heard of till listening to some of your work, which are compounds that break down B1, correct? Like kind of anti-nutrients?
Yeah. I mean, you can find them in kind of raw seafood. I think you can find them in kind of molds and other kind of compounds. I can't remember the other foods that they're found in, to be honest, right now. I think, you know, things like coffee and that can have a kind of thiaminase-like effect. Yeah, I think coffee will need kind of more thiamine within the diet if you're kind of consuming lots of that. Obviously, it has many beneficial other things like manganese and other things. But I think that thiamine can be increased, primarily also as well, because you're stimulating the oxidative pathway. And when you stimulate the oxidative pathway to utilize more carbohydrates, you're going to stimulate the need for more B1, more B2, sometimes more B3. If there's, you know, a factor in there that's going to break that down, then, and you're consuming, say, a diet that's high in the thiaminases, like people who chow down on lots of sushi, for an example, that might be kind of put them at risk of kind of needing more thiamine, as an example.
That's interesting too, because like you hear about the sushi and heavy metal things, you could wonder that the thyroid might decrease their ability to detox the heavy metals.
Mercury has obviously a specific inhibitory pathway at the selenoproteins within the thyroid gland itself. So perhaps you could have a double whammy with high sushi diet there, increased mercury and increased thiamine reduction or kind of degradation. So that's quite important to consider.
Yeah, that is interesting. Do you have any favorite sources of B1 from food that you recommend and supplements as well? I've been doing a little bit more garlic. Georgie has talked about that. The allethiamine that's naturally found in garlic. And I know pork has a decent amount, especially if you get pastured pork, which is obviously, I mean, I don't know if it changes the B1 quantity, but just better from less PUFAs.
And then my general sources, and you know, I think you can get some more from different grains and products as well. And sometimes you can find it in meats as well as a good source, particularly the meat juices. So I think, to be honest, I've not got my head in sources of thiamine at the moment, just because I'm just so focused on the thyroid research, but I've put it all in a seminar somewhere. But they're useful. Pork is good. It's probably one of the higher ones. Pork liver as well. Has a decent source, and some of the other livers as well, like cow and I think cow and pork liver are one of the highest contents.
How do you view the cruciferous vegetables, that like the glucosinates and all that stuff that can have a anti-thyroid effect?
I used to be more stringent on them, and I don't eat many of them anyway, and I have a lot of clients that come to me, and you can see, you know, I wrote an old blog years ago. I just started loading them back up to my website again because I transferred over, and one is called How to Keep Your Chain Maintained, and it talks about how in a diet that's in an environment that's producing lots of cyanide and cyanide-like compounds, when that kind of meets someone who's trying to be really healthy and eating lots of these kind of glucosinolates and thiocyanates, that can be a problem, I think, especially when vegetables are undercooked. I don't think there's anything wrong with having broccoli or kind of spinach, as long as it's well cooked in the diet a few times a week. I think that, you know, it's still the idea that eating lots of these vegetables can be problematic. Sometimes it can increase the iodine requirement, for sure. I think you still see lots of kind of promotion of the ideas that some of them are superfoods. Like, for example, there's an Indian spinach, begins with M, I think. I can't remember what it was. It's constantly being promoted as a superfood, but it has a clear thyroid disrupting effect. So you see this in powder form that's being sold as a superfood, but nobody talks about the thyroid disrupting effects. You have to go and look at that. Nobody mentions that. So we still get the idea that these foods are powerhouses, and they should be consumed in large amounts. And I still think being prudent with those type of foods and cooking them really well and only having a few times a week is particularly useful. A lot of kind of functional med and other kind of alternative practitioners would talk about the sulforaphane and the other compounds in there, and chow down on them on a daily basis. But again, there are, you know, the risk reward with any type of food is like, you have to look at what it's doing long term and what are the effects. And if, for example, you are experiencing low body temperature, poor energy production, and you're suffering from a host of those type of symptoms, then you're looking at your diet and kind of, you know, reviewing whether eating lots of those is a good thing is certainly prudent. So I'm probably not as full on about them, but I still kind of say, look, you know, with new clients, this is something you want to cut out in the short term just to see how you get on. And usually it is eating an abundance of those can cause quite a few problems, but certainly it's a couple of times a week and it's well cooked. It's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they can have benefits in small amounts, like a couple of times a week, well cooked?
Yeah, I think they can. There will be, you know, different substances we talked about, you know, sulforaphane as being perhaps one. And, you know, I think the idea around, you know, metabolizing estrogen, that there are probably small benefits to be had. But again, there are many other benefits that you can be had by kind of following other pathways of keeping your energy up, keeping your thyroid maintained, ensuring that, you know, xenoestrogens aren't able to do their work, eating enough carbohydrate in the diet, getting enough light, you know, all of these kind of things can be just as beneficial. And I'd certainly kind of, I'd rather people didn't go mad on eating like lots of these raw green vegetables, because I think they do have an effect.
Agreed. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I want to ask you about the combination of the retin. You mentioned a little bit before, I don't know why I'm giving you an X, the retinoid X receptor, thyroid and cholesterol and their role in metabolism and the steroid metabolism.
Sure. I mean, there are some similarities between how the both retinol and thyroid are transported, you know, by the carrier proteins, and also how they interact at the cell with receptors. So, for example, like transthyretin carries both retinol with retinol binding protein and T4. And this is T4 tends to be more easily hijacked. We talk about certain pollutants and excess of fatty acids can be thrown off there. I think what's really interesting is that they both have very clear effects on differentiation of tissue, how tissue is formed and how organized it is. And also the idea that at the receptor, the thyroid receptor, hormone receptor, shares the same, pretty much the same kind of the space, the same real estate as the retinoid X receptor. Now, what tends to happen is that in a configuration, they can bind at the receptor. It can either homodimerize, which is T3 with T3, or it can do something called heterodimerize, which is basically it can form with the retinoid receptor. And the idea of the retinoid actually stabilizes the T3. So it kind of binds. I think they're synergistic at quite a few levels. And I think a deficiency in either of them can cause problems. Just like with steroidogenesis, if there's a lack of T3, we tend to see disruption to testosterone, progesterone, even estrogens to a degree, but depending on how much saturation of estrogens there are, how many xenoestrogens as pollutants that are kind of driving that kind of chaotic effect. So I think cholesterol, we know that as an example is that cholesterol is converted into the base hormone pregnenolone, and you certainly need enough vitamin A to do that. You certainly need enough thyroid to do that. So I think, whether it's, again, just like during sickness, thyroid hormone can be decreased. Now, some people look at it as the non-thyroidal illness syndrome where you'll have the low T3. But equally, if you look at kind of what happens to vitamin A as well, is that the sicker you are and the longer you stay sick, you deplete retinol concentrations. And this is why people will require more retinol. You can argue the idea that you can get it from carotenoids, but I think the carotenoids in excess are way more toxic than retinol more efficiently. You can have an excess of retinol. You can have an excess of carotenoids, but the excess of carotenoids, because it's a pro vitamin A rather than preformed, will have more negative effects rather than more rapidly. And hence why you'll see this kind of carotenoid, this orange colouring within the fat pads of the hands. So there's some synergy there at multiple levels, but I think you can't have one without the other. And this is why I think you tend to see in whether it's kind of sickness and disease, thyroid hormone and retinol, and this will ultimately decrease steroid conversion, whether it's kind of, within key structures like the testicles or the ovaries. So I think these are important things to maintain.
Do you think a lot of the steroid hormone, like the decline in steroid hormones, like low T that's being talked about a lot today, is from maybe less so from the estrogens that are in the environment, which, I mean, yes, we talked about also having an indirect effect, or could have a direct effect too, but all, could be very much so from the hypothyroidism, the subclinical hypothyroidism that a lot of people are exhibiting. So they're just not able to produce enough.
Well, I think the conversion becomes a problem to start with. So if you've got a mass part of the population that is low in thyroid function, the capacity to go through that kind of steroidogenic pathway is compromised. I mean, there's more cholesterol around, but you can't use it, as an example. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why you look at some of the studies for mortality, actually, there seems to be increased risk with total cholesterol below 200 in some of the large, big studies. I'm talking like 12 million people reviews and that. But, seeing a cholesterol value between 200 and 250 seems to be optimal from that perspective. So generally, the more you have around, the better. But at the same point, if you can't use it, you can't convert it. And therefore, you get this impeded pathway. So where everything should be going, spilling off to its pathways, whether it's pregnenolone, allopregnenolone, progesterone, testosterone, estrogen not so much because it tends to be abundant and easily achieved. I think that is one of the problems. And just like I'm going to start looking at, you know, how T4 affects testicles and some of the cell function, and then apply these pollutants very, very shortly. And I'll kind of have some idea of that later on in the year with some of these more novel pollutants. But I think it's the idea at the moment is that there is restriction, and just like you can have binding. I mean, you have these kind of steroid hormone, that what's called the super receptor family, which is kind of very similar to the thyroid receptor and the retinoid X receptor. You have the androgen receptor, the estrogen receptor, the glucocorticoid receptor, and then you have the kind of pro-inflammatory, pro-pollutant pathways like the pregnenolone receptor and the CAR receptor, which kind of are activated when there are higher levels of pollution, and will also increase the degradation of steroid hormones and T3 as well. It becomes an issue when you have a combination of, you know, increased pollutants. You could argue, I think, the idea that, you know, decreasing body temperature, which has been observed now for a while, is a driving factor, and it kind of combines the thyroid hormone and androgens and other kind of steroidal hormones might be having an impact in that. We know, for example, that, say, progesterone is a prothermogenic kind of hormone. It can increase body temperature, it can help to sustain or improve oxidative phosphorylation as well. So I think we're getting multiple levels of kind of degradation, chaos, and not being able to regulate hormones and energy at large from the environment.
We've talked a lot about a lot of the pollutants, and that's really what you're specializing in. How do you think, and you're obviously in the country, which is a lot better being in the city, but for us city folk, do you think the big rocks for, like, what would you prioritize in terms of avoiding the pollutants and how to avoid them? And then you mentioned briefly taking thyroid, but things that you can use to, like, maybe accelerate their detoxification or make them have less of an effect.
Well, I think in the house is like kind of understanding what things are useful, what create risk. And as I said, dust seems to be one of the most common themes in both the office and the home. If you're working in an office, hard to get away from. But if you're in home, you know, get that dust cleaned up quickly. Try to avoid, you know, even if you've got like, say, sofa, having a leather sofa is probably going to be better than having a fabric one. Although there's going to be flame retardant inside it, you're kind of sitting on leather that's not been treated with flame retardants most of the time. And bearing in mind that, you know, flame retardants, I use about this, just flame retardants, and I'm a bit of a bore about them at the moment because it's just something I'm looking at, is that they can be absorbed by, you know, dermal contact, inhalation and ingestion. So it's just, you know, there's these things, you know, trying to avoid the obvious things. I think, you know, avoiding fluoridated water is an example for thyroid health. I think, you know, so having a good water filter in the house, choosing food choices that kind of, you know, decrease the likelihood, you know, even organic farming has certain chemicals on them, and it's hard to get away from that. But, you know, I think air quality within the home as well. You know, I used to live in Dubai, so I had an air filter running all the time. And if you have AC, getting that checked all the time, because that tends to harbor a lot of issues. I had mold poisoning 2 or 3 times now from living in a kind of AC environment that was running all year round. So, you know, it's just looking at things like, you know, avoiding scratch Teflon pans, you know, there's a list. I keep meaning to write up a list for clients of, well, I've got a kind of brief synopsis, but I mean, what I don't want to do is try and get people becoming so kind of fearful and constricted, because that can be a detriment to their health, in effect, by just creating the worry about what they're not doing. And there are lots of things that you can do, and some of the stuff you can't really change anyway, but just being, I think, in a mindset where you've done some things and you're feeling in good health and you're doing all you can, having that effect of, like, you're feeling better and you're more inclined to deal with some of the threats that come out your way. Getting out of urban environments all the time, I think, is useful. Heading off to kind of low EMF areas, which is hard to get away even more and more. And certainly getting away from the fine particulate matter air pollution, you know, 2.5 particulate matters, that can be kind of problematic as well. And the combustion engines, you know, it's about giving your body a break if you are in those areas. And I think there's a lot that you can do to mitigate that. So you're going in and out of that all the time. So almost the body kind of, you know, can deal with it, and it can see perhaps that it's going away and being able to deal with it and have a downtime, and then getting you to go back into it again. I think that can be quite useful.
Yeah, I think that's great. Those are some great tips. You mentioned before using thyroid as a means of kind of like accelerating the process of their breakdown. Do you think a lot of people today, due to the pollutants that we're exposed to, should be taking thyroid, in your opinion? Not any medical advice, but
I think it becomes a very subjective consideration, because some people clearly need it and some people don't. And it's just working out what that is. You know, this is why you can look at, say, temperature and pulse as an example. You can look at those additional blood tests to see if there's a real need for it. You know, it's clear that T3 can reverse and ameliorate the damage of certain pollutants. It's clear that some pollutants can have an effect like T3. So it's working it out, and it becomes difficult to say, does everybody need it? No. Do more and more people might need it, because there's more and more hypothyroid people perhaps being in the environment, just being directly exposed to pollutants, you know, kind of holding transgenerational changes. We know that hypothyroid parents pass on hypothyroid traits into their offspring. So that probably leaves the door open, unless they get a chance to resolve or, you know, kind of compete against the things that are breaking their physiology down, they're more likely to go down that pathway. And that pathway seems to be harder to recognize, again, if you just look at the TSH and the other blood tests.
Yeah, my dad has always had a normal, I'm convinced he's hypothyroidism, because he has a pulse of like, he has a relatively regular body temperature. I think it's a little bit low, which is another sign, but he has a pulse of like 46, and he's always blamed that to being a cardiovascular, he's an endurance athlete. And then he's like, yeah, I process sugar terribly. I'm like, well, there's a reason you're processing sugar terribly. What do you typically do with a client like that?
I don't work with them most of the time, because just primarily because most of the people would be coming, and they would be kind of open to the idea that something's not working for them. I kind of had my fair share of people that have come on. So come on, it's just not working for me. I said, okay, I can appreciate you having a negative experience, but maybe it's because you've gone too quickly. Maybe we need to increase the amount of thiamine or B2 in there. Maybe it's because you need thyroid hormone. Maybe you're eating too much. You know, there are many nuances about how people utilize glucose. You know, some people just load up too quickly. Some people eat carbohydrates and then go, oh yeah, I'm just not tolerating carbohydrates. And I think the idea of carb intolerance is erroneous, because it gives the idea that you have an intolerance to carbohydrates, but it's not the intolerance. It's just your body has broken down so much. It doesn't know how to use them. That's therefore going slow, or kind of combining all of the things that are going to help you to improve, you know, entry of glucose into the cell, whether it's kind of modulating insulin, whether it's more B1, B2, B3, you know, maybe it's more light that you need to stimulate these pathways. You know, there's so many different things, but people just blame, it's a typical thing, they blame the carbohydrate. Can you eat too much carbohydrate? Yeah, that's always possible as well, but it's usually not that.
He's like, I've got my thyroid tested too. It's always come back in the normal ranges. And that was one of the things that really dove me into thyroid. Cause I'm just like, how do I determine an answer for this? Cause it's like, you know, it's like, it's almost like if a doctor, you go to a doctor and you thought you had, or they had cancer, and you say you no longer have this, which is, you know, you're in, I forget what the term is, but it's a red light, green light. It's like you either have it or you don't. Versus like, this is like, there's a huge range where it's, I feel like he has so many other symptoms, and I don't mean to like be specific to him, but he has so many other symptoms that I'm just like, I could have, like, there's children, high school teachers that could tell you have hypothyroidism, but this marker is like so declarative in medical literature today. It's just so interesting.
Yeah, I think the symptom presentation is key. And, you know, you could argue that people who are endurance athletes, well, I tell you what, the thing is, there's a huge muddying of the water between hypothyroidism and athletic heart. So, you know, that adaptive response. So where is that? I mean, you know, and I think the idea of the symptoms, if they're cardiovascular, if they're kind of function related, you know, you can prop yourself up by doing lots of endurance exercise. And that's why people will say, oh yeah, I love to do exercise. You know, I'm not going to exercise. Exercise needs to be done on a regular basis and something I recommend and do myself. But the idea is that you're propping your physiology up by warming it up to make yourself feel better. Hence, you want to exercise every single day to prop your body temperature up, to get you up there. You get an increase in heart rate. You get an increase in energy production, but at the same time, you know, if you stop that for a couple of days, you tend to come crashing down, and you'll see kind of stiffness. Remember that, you know, magnesium in the body is bound to ATP, and when you don't have enough magnesium because you're kind of hypothyroid, because you tend to waste magnesium and it's not being bound to ATP efficiently, the body, the ability to get the contraction relaxation of your muscles, hence why the, you know, the Achilles tendon reflex is a really good test for diagnosing low thyroid function. And again, I think even with that test that there's some muddying of the waters of people who kind of are propping themselves up with exercise and adrenaline. I think there can be kind of relationships there where it might not be so clear and overt as this really overt hypothyroidism, where you tap the tendon, it's clear, kind of contracts, but then relaxes slowly. So I think using these other tests can be really, really good. We know that people that tend to do endurance exercise, they're used to kind of running off adrenaline and cortisol. They're used to suppressing thyroid hormone. TSH can appear completely normal there because they are stressing the body out with exercise. It could be a positive stress, could be a detrimental stress where they're kind of going, robbing the body at some stage because they're not getting enough nutrients in. You know, the ability to train, relax, come back and train well again without injury, being able to function, you know, there are good signs of whether the that's a good thing for them or not. And I think there are too many people that muddy the waters by doing that constant go to the gym every day or train really, really hard. And that's, you know, get them to take a few days off, a week off, see how they feel. And then you go, I feel terrible. Well, it's not an exercise deficiency that's driving that. There are clear metabolic disturbances that are causing that. And if you're kind of stiff and injuring all the time, that can be a key sign of that.
So when you work with someone that is demonstrating these subclinical signs of hypothyroidism and they're really big endurance athletes, do you think endurance training is enough of a stress that you'll try and get them to stop? Or do you try and work with them because, you know, they really enjoy blank exercise? Or is it kind of just figuring it out if you can balance the two?
I think it depends. It really depends as whether it's breaking them down or not. And some people, I've had some clients doing cardio kind of like and doing training like 5-6 days a week. You know, some are very receptive to going, look, I don't mind you doing cardio, but just go for long walks. You know, challenge the body with a long walk and breathing through the mouth and do 2 or 3 strength training sessions a week. And I've seen some people respond really, really well to that. I think it depends on the personality type and, you know, what they see as being, you know, we go back to the carbohydrate use, for example, and, you know, people gaining weight very quickly on carbohydrates. It's like they start to see that and they'll kind of blame it on the carbohydrates. And it's the same with exercise. It's like if you stop exercise and automatically you start gaining weight very quickly, that is not an exercise deficiency. You should be able to stop exercise and even drop a little bit of weight, because often you don't kind of you know, you're not trying to constantly increase hypertrophy. You're not trying to constantly keep the cells flooded with glucose, depending on what stage of training you're in of that. But it's like people who stop exercising gain weight really quickly. People that start gaining weight because eating carbohydrates, there's a deficit there that needs resolving. And I think it depends on the person, the type of personality, what their level of conditioning. And I mean the conditioning, their mental conditioning about what they've been exposed to from an information perspective, because there are so many people that are ingrained out there that carbohydrates are the devil, and that the, you know, and the carbs cause this and this. You just have to go to a keto or a low carb carnivore kind of forum and see that. And I think that's kind of sad, because I think it just shows a lack of understanding of biology, mm-hmm. to be honest, more than anything else.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting, your point of how I don't want to like misquote you, but like kind of that certain people that, let's say, are hypothyroidism may gravitate towards these more intense endurance exercises to get that body temperature increase. And then you also just mentioned, like, they might, because that leads more towards the keto, the fat burning pathways, they might be like, they might, oh, I feel way better when I'm a keto. So it's kind of like this, you know, pushing them towards this side when we really want, and like, oh, I feel great. I'm on keto. I run 30 miles a day and I haven't slept in 6 weeks. Versus we want to pull them back into the rest and digest and relaxation state.
Yeah. I think symptoms are a great, great driver. And a good presentation for people to work with. So a lot of people say, do any blood tests come, and I go, no, just let's just see how you're functioning. Let's see what the symptoms are. I get enough of that to give you an idea of a couple of interventions to go away and work with. I would resolve, look for tests if things aren't going the right way, because, you can go and get tests done and it's not representative of where you are. It's kind of being masked by lots of things. So I think it's useful to look at the symptoms, and, sleep disturbance is a big one there for sure.
Can you just give a brief rundown of the symptoms? So you said sleep disturbances, high cholesterol is one of them, because it's not getting, the thyroid's not pushing the cholesterol into the cell to get it used. I believe high blood pressure is one of them.
Yeah, hyperglycemia can be one as well. So metabolic syndrome can be a key presentation of low thyroid function. Certainly the blood pressure that you talked about. Certainly menstrual disturbances, certainly androgen disturbances, low progesterone. Not always, though. Certainly high estrogen. Certainly low testosterone, cognition, mood. We talked about anxiety and depression, kidney function as a good indicator, cardiac function as a good indicator. Certainly, I think cardiac disease is probably a really good indicator of lack of thyroid function. Not to say it's everything, but I think when you understand thyroid hormone's effect on the heart, when you understand calcification of the arteries, that you can understand why heart disease is a key component of low thyroid function. And there are other things as well, skin health, muscle injuries, chronic muscle injuries as an example, movement disturbances, typically in your kind of overt hypothyroid, you might see people as this kind of sluggish, slow moving type of person. But just bear in mind that, many of the older thyroid researchers, classified or their observation that anorexia was often present in low thyroid function. And that would obviously is a chicken and egg question, because when you don't eat enough, you don't produce enough thyroid hormone, but you still lose weight, right? So the idea of someone who's low thyroid as being overweight or obese, or at least kind of holding more body fat compared to a hyperthyroid person that is kind of, no body weight, very, very thin, is fairly erroneous, because you can be malnourished and be significantly hypothyroid.
Yeah, it's interesting tying what you said before about the passing on the hypothyroidism to, parent to offspring. And then you think about everyone talking about how you have the familial history of heart disease and things like that, where it's like, well, you could, and I also think about like diet and all that stuff being passed on genetically as well. How those two are so interrelated that it could be like, it may not be you're predisposed to heart disease, you're just predisposed to hypothyroidism, which is a predisposition to heart disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is not something to look at. I always like to ask clients, what their mum and dad's health like. You can go back to their grandparents sometimes. And I think if you're not understanding that, it's not the failing of clinicians or kind of physicians to do that, because they're kind of not in that job. They're not in the job of understanding the problem. They're understanding of kind of ticking boxes and algorithmic medicine, where they're prescribing something for a clear problem that kind of resolves, or at least manages a symptom, but doesn't resolve it. And I think if we kind of get a better understanding of thyroid hormone, I think that can lead us to kind of certainly better outcomes. And my bias is a huge instrument of thyroid hormone. There are other things outside of thyroid hormones, but I think when you understand the complexity that thyroid hormone brings to the table, you can get an understanding of why. I don't think we really understand it well enough still.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was, how does thyroid physiology impact digestion?
One of the key things that goes, you could argue the first thing it does, it stops you thinking about food. And when you stop thinking about food, you don't produce the salivary response. And you could argue that the people who are running around off chronic stress sat at their computer tapping away and eating food, the first things they're not doing is thinking about the salivary response and how tasty food is. They're chucking it down. But ultimately, one of the big things is that both the pancreas and the stomach are thyroid responsive. So if you don't get production of pepsin, you know, hydrochloric acid as an example, the chief cells which produce those and the pepsin producing cells, you're not going to break down your food with the intense acidity that the stomach brings to the table as both a sanitizing agent to restrict nefarious kind of organisms getting into your digestive system, like bacteria or nematodes or whatever. So that's going to be decreased. You're also not going to break down the food sufficiently. So it's when it's triggered and released into, you know, the relatively alkaline compared to the stomach, a high acid environment, you're also not going to get the triggering or the production of the digestive enzymes. So the pancreas not only produces insulin, it produces, you know, elastase and or, you know, lipase and the, you know, all of the products that help to break down proteins, fats and carbohydrates. Now, if you're not producing enough of those, then your digestion is decreased. That means the food and the bolus that's actually into the intestines is not broken down enough. It attracts more microbes. It's more likely to produce more aspects of endotoxin, which means it's going to increase, you know, damage to where the brush border enzymes are. The gastrointestinal tract is going to make it leakier. We know that high levels of fatty acids within the digestive tract make it leakier. So when you get a combination of poorly digested foods, agents that shouldn't be there that can take a hold, more damage to the kind of villi and microvilli and the gap junctions where these kind of villi sit on. So you've got these gap junctions here where these kind of foods should migrate through. This can cause a problem that is the problem that is called leaky gut or intestinal hyperpermeability. So, you know, thyroid function could create intestinal hyperpermeability. Then you've got the added problems of what the chemicals do from the pollutants that can damage the gastrointestinal tract as well. So it becomes a very vicious cycle of high pollutant load, low thyroid function, foods that can irritate the bowel, chemicals that can irritate the bowel, you know, actions that can cause poor pancreatic function. So I think this is kind of something that it's not just, you know, how the thyroid is, it's all the other things that come with it. You could argue that just sitting down thinking about eating your food could have a pro-thyroid response because you're not running off adrenaline, you're calming yourself down. Perhaps you're going to do a few breaths where you increase the amount of carbon dioxide, stabilize your body that is your organism, and then kind of get used to digesting your food. So it kind of comes with lots of little things that you can bring into the equation to kind of to help modulate thyroid, to help improve digestion.
Awesome, Keith. Thank you so much for coming on. This was great, very informative. You're so well informed. It's awesome to hear. I would love to dig in another time to some of your more research on the pollutants and everything like that. But where can everyone find you?
I'm not in too many places. I'm on Instagram. I think I'm still down as Tom Littlewood. There is a Balanced Body Mind Facebook page. I've just started using Twitter a bit more since I joined it in 2009, and I haven't really been on there in 11 or 12 years. So I've just started using that a bit more. That's generally it.
And your website is awesome. I've read a ton of your blogs. Like, you do a great job of elaborating these things. And I haven't taken the sleep mini course. I'm going to take that eventually. But your article on coffee was highly recommended if anyone's looking for it's maybe a leeway into some of Ray Pete's work, into getting some more background there.
Yeah, I've just migrated the website. So I've got to go back and put 10 years of podcasts back onto this new website, which is taking its time. But I try and put as much free stuff out there as possible. There's some membership kind of seminars, and there's a hormones nutrition seminars page, which I did have it as a membership only. But now when people join, I just send them a Dropbox full of all the lessons, all the videos and all the reading material that's available for them. So that's still going strong, and I appreciate anybody that kind of comes my way from that. So thank you for letting me mention that.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much. And Keith, you also have a PhD fund correct? Can people donate there?
I've actually stopped that now. Okay. Because I reached my desired goal, which was about 60% of the fees. So I've actually stopped the things. People can support me just by, you know, I have a small supplement shop. I don't go anywhere to hawk them, but I use that to kind of support my PhD. I'm available for consultations or the hormone seminars. So and anything like that. So it is greatly appreciated. But just interacting with people is just fine too.
Well, Keith, that was great. Thank you so much for coming on and have a good one.